The following previews are of graphic audio productions rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Eagles 8, Blood of Eagles. The Oklahoma Panhandle is 100 miles of lawlessness and danger, a no man's land designed to separate Texas from pro-union Kansas. Through this desolate strip rides legendary gunslinger Falcon McAllister with a 12-year-old Indian boy by his side. Behind them lies a scene of horror left by a band of outlaws who've murdered the boy's parents and massacred the settlers of a small wagon train. And the list of atrocities doesn't end there.
What did you call me? Did you call me crazy?
Come on, Billy. Back off. It's just a way of talking. Damned if you ain't the contrariest critter I ever seen.
You know who used to call me crazy, Tuck? My mother did. My own mother. Can you beat that? The old bitch said I was crazy as a loon, just like you said a time or two.
Well, I'm sorry, Billy, but I...
Do you know what I did when I heard that too much, Tuck? She said that one too many times. And I took a strop knife to her. I knocked her down, then I busted open her jaw, and I cut out her damn tongue.
You killed her? You killed your own mother?
Hell no, I didn't. I let her do that herself.
As they search the panhandle for the killers, Falcon and Wahatli enter a storm of greed, thievery, and betrayal that has its roots in two long, gleaming bands of steel. A new railway is penetrating this hostile land, meaning riches to some and death to many. Into this maelstrom ride a boy and a gunfighter on their own brutal search for retribution.
Falcon! Behind you on the roof!
Falcon ducked and turned, feeling a jab of lingering pain as his .44 came up. A man with a yellow sash pitched headfirst from the roof of the old trading post. Falcon was past the big wagon when some impulse made him turn and duck. There in the street, rising out of the settling dust, was a man as big as Falcon himself. A man with a smoking gun in his hand. Falcon dodged, tumbled, and rolled, and the pain in his middle became a living thing. Two more bullets kicked up dirt beside him, and he rolled again, coming up on his elbows to return fire. The specter in the dust dodged wildly and ran. In an instant, he was out of sight behind the wagon. Falcon came to his feet, advancing. A broken down trough hid the underside of the wagon, and he started around it, then doubled back and went the other way. Asa Parker was waiting for him, crouched in shadows behind a tall wheel. He held a ready .45 and leaned outward, ready to shoot the instant Falcon cleared the water trough. Falcon circled around the lashed-up tongue and stepped past the iron tire of the all-four wheel.
Time's up, Parker. Colorado or die.
The glory and danger of the Wild West live on in Eagles number 8, Blood of Eagles.
Available now from Graphic Audio.
If you dialed correctly, you know my name. Speak.
Mistress.
All is well, I trust.
Yes. We had an accident this evening.
You must tell me all about it. In person.
I would be delighted. Shall I bring something?
Bring your obedience worm.
Do we have a crisis?
Mr. President, we appear to have a foreign submarine operating off New England. It may be interfering with commercial fishing.
Did you say fishing?
Yes, you are aware of the fishing crisis.
In New York, UN Secretary General Anwar Sadat has made a claim that is creating quite a stir in diplomatic circles. It seems, according to the Secretary General, that a U.S. Coast Guard cutter and a submarine suspected to be of Canadian origin, French-Canadian origin to be precise, clashed in disputed waters on the Grand Banks, with the result that the sub was sunk with all hands aboard. It is a sign that individual nations cannot be trusted to oversee their own territorial waters, and that a UN High Commission should be established to patrol and safeguard the high seas. Mr. Sadat claims that such patrols would serve to protect the much overfished stocks that are the cause of so much international friction these days.
Mr. President, I am very distressed by the friction between your nation and the Canadians.
I could use your help.
It is a consequence, I think, of the extension of the 200-mile limits and the fierce quest for diminishing fish. As the leader of the former free world, I must ask you to reconsider your 200-mile limit.
Reconsider it how?
Roll it back. Unilaterally. If you make this gesture, other nations may follow your lead. Then the international waters will be truly free again.
The world's ears are turned in your direction, my Anwar.
Although my duty calls for me to be here, I will come to your city wherever it may be.
Ottawa, come tonight.
We will laugh, we will dance, and we will dine on one another's charms.
And we will confer with the Canadian Minister of Fisheries.
Both schemes are mine. Now they are one. You have both worked my will in the world. Now you will work together.
What exactly are your goals?
To plunge the world into the Red Abyss. Who is this who invades my domain?
Who is this who demands such answers of us?
I am Mistress Kali.
If you are Mistress Kali, then you will recognize my companion, who is sometimes called Shiva the Destroyer.
The Destroyer, number 106, Whitewater, is available now on Graphic Audio. Don't be surprised if you get hooked.
Do you desire to enter into the presence of Mistress Kali?
And now, for our feature presentation.
Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone's Blood Bond. Narrated by Thomas Penny. With performances by Dylan Lynch, James Lewis, David Coyne, James Konacek, Nanette Savard, Jeff Baker, Sonny Lasky, Terrence Aselford, Richard Rowan, Tim Carlin, Michael Raplogel, Bruce Rauscher, Ken Jackson, Christopher Graybill, Nathaniel Perry, Chris Rowan, and Mort Shelby.
The man's body was still warm, and Matt Bodine's eyes did not linger long on the tortured flesh. One look at the expression on his dead face told him everything. Bodine stood up and carefully swept his surroundings with his eyes, missing nothing. He walked back to his horse and picked up the reins where he'd ground-reined the big line-backed dun stallion, tying him to a low branch. Then the man squatted down and pondered the situation, not liking any of it. This act of torture was supposed to look like the work of Indians, but after only a hasty look around, Bodine knew it wasn't. The men who had done this all wore moccasins, but they didn't walk like Indians. They walked like white men. They had also stepped on a couple of branches, breaking them. No Indian would have done that, unless he was drunk. Bodine stood up. He was a tall, lean, good-looking young man in his mid-20s. He wore walnut-handled .44 Colts. In the boot was a Winchester .44, loaded full up with 17 rounds. Bodine carried a long-bladed bowie knife and a sheath behind the right-hand Colt. He wore faded jeans, scuffed boots, and a buckskin shirt made for him by a squaw in his adopted Cheyenne tribe. They adopted him when Bodine was just a young boy. He also wore a necklace of three multicolored rocks around his neck, pierced by a leather thong. Bodine glanced at the body. He knew what he had to do, and he wasn't happy. He crossed to the corpse and pulled the naked man away from the nearly dead fire. He looked around, found the man's clothes, and began to go through them. That would be the army patrol he was scouting for. He waited until they came into view and waved them to a halt, walking over to them so they would not trample any sign he might pick up later.
Damned heathens.
Lieutenant Gary was new to the West, having been posted in Montana only a few months back. But it hadn't taken him long to hate the Indians.
It wasn't Indians. White men did this. The scalping is all wrong. It was very carefully done. Indians usually just cut a line and then tear the scalp loose. And those aren't Indian moccasin prints over there. White men wore those moccasins. I haven't started looking for other signs.
Gary dismounted and walked to Bodine's side. He glanced over at the tortured man.
You know him?
No. But I know this. Someone didn't like him very much.
Gary looked hard at Bodine to see if the scout was kidding. He couldn't tell. Bodine's face was impossible to read. Gary had been briefed about Bodine on his first day at the fort. Colonel Travers had both complimented and cursed Bodine.
Bodine doesn't have to work for us, Lieutenant, although I'm glad he does. Bodine has money. His father owns probably the largest ranch in Wyoming Territory, down on the Crazy Woman. Bodine has his own spread and runs his own cattle. His spread is on the Powder and butts into his father's ranch. Together, they control thousands of acres. Not only that, but they own it. They filed on some, proved it up, and staked it out. They bought the rest and hold legitimate deeds.
If he's so wealthy, why does he work for the Army for $50 a month?
Best answer I can give you is because he wants to. I give Bodine very few orders. I suggest a lot of things to him, but that doesn't mean he's going to do it. My adjutant, Major Dawson, gave Bodine a direct order one time. Bodine told him to stick it in his hat. He refuses to sign any contract with the Army.
Maybe he can't write.
Bodine's mother was trained as a schoolteacher, Gary. He's well-educated for a man raised on the frontier. He's also an adopted member of the Cheyenne tribe, a blood brother to Two Wolves, the son of Medicine Horse. No one knows this country like Bodine. No one.
But we are at war with the Cheyenne.
We're at war with certain elements of the tribe. We are not at war with Medicine Horse, and I pray to God we never will be. Medicine Horse was educated back east, married a white woman from Vermont. They had one son before she died of fever. Two Wolves. Sam August Webster Two Wolves. He can read and write and speak English, although he prefers his father's tongue. He's also a damn troublemaker.
That conversation rolled through Gary's head as he watched Bodine cast for signs, walking in slow, aimless circles around the small clearing. He disappeared into the brush, and moments later popped back out behind the cavalry.
All their horses were shod, which doesn't mean a whole lot. Lots of Indians ride shod horses they've stolen.
Murdering thieves.
The taking of horses is a game to them, Lieutenant. And before the white man came along, many Indians didn't kill unless forced to it. Indians didn't invent scalping. The white man did. Toss a dead man across his saddle and come on. His horse is over there.
Bodine was on his mean-eyed stallion and gone before Gary could mount up. It irked him. He was supposed to be giving orders to the scout, not the other way around. Bodine would listen politely and attentively when Gary outlined what they would do in the field, and then Bodine would do the opposite. It was irritating. After all, Gary was a West Point man. The trail led to a small settlement on the still ill-defined Montana-Wyoming border. The town was a den of iniquity, populated by soiled doves, gamblers, thieves, rustlers, murderers, and the like. Gary had never been to the town of Cutter. Tell the truth, he was naively looking forward to it. The small patrol rode down the wide street, all the men conscious of eyes on them, and most of the eyes were anything but friendly.
We'll lose the trail here. We might find the horses, we might even find the men, but that won't give us anything that would stand up in any court of law. They'll just say they found the body and came into town to report it. There is no law in Cutter, Gary, so watch yourself.
I am perfectly capable of taking care of myself, Bodine.
A woman seated on the second floor balcony of the Kitty Cat Saloon got Gary's attention.
Ooh, it's the cavalry come to save us. Come on up, army man, and save me from a boring afternoon. You can leave your boots on if you like.
Lieutenant Gary's face turned red, and Sergeant Tom Simmons, a grizzled veteran of many years on the frontier, had to struggle to keep from laughing out loud. A man pointed to the horse with the body of the tortured man lashed across the saddle.
See? I told you all what we seen!
It's that damn murdering half-breed and his bunch of dead dish!
They're talking about two wolves?
Yes, and someone at the fort has been talking as well. Whoever set this thing up had to know the area we would be patrolling so we could find the body. Think about it.
Everyone on the post knew. It might not have been deliberate.
That's true. I'm just wondering what Two Wolves has done this time to get everyone so stirred up.
They reined up in front of the combination dentist-barber-undertaker's building and dismounted. The same man filled all three jobs. A crowd began to gather.
Your show, Lieutenant.
Anyone here know this man?
Sergeant Simmons lifted the dead man's bloody head with a gloved hand.
I seen him around a time or two. He drifted in here from Idaho, I think. Called himself George.
Any last name?
Not that I ever heard.
The undertaker pushed his way through the crowd.
Does he have any coins in his pockets?
A few greenbacks.
Yeah, that'll do for a simple burying. Some of you boys get him into the back.
You soldier boys come to get Two Wolves?
We don't know that Two Wolves had anything to do with this. We were on routine patrol when Bodine found the body.
Eyes shifted from the lieutenant to the scout. Not being a terribly talkative man, Bodine could spend several days in a town and leave without anyone knowing his name. But they all knew his reputation. Matt Bodine had killed his first man when he was 14. The man's brothers came after the boy when he was 15. They got lead in Bodine, but when the gun smoke cleared, Bodine was standing over their bodies. At 16, rustlers struck his father's ranch. Bodine's guns put two men in the ground and wounded another two. At 17, Bodine was a grown man and went off to live with the Cheyenne for a year. He'd been spending time with them, sometimes weeks at a time, since he was a boy. At 18, he was riding shotgun for gold shipments. At 19, he began part-time scouting for the Army. Between 19 and 25, the guns of Matt Bodine became legend in the West. But not just his guns, for Bodine's fists were just as feared. He knew Indian wrestling, boxing, and barroom brawling.
You Bodine, huh?
That's right.
My name's Simon Bull.
Is that supposed to impress me?
Bodine had heard of Bull. He was a fast gun and was just as good as his reputation.
It might... someday.
Bull turned and stomped off, disappearing into a saloon.
You always try that hard to make friends?
See you sometime tomorrow.
Before Gary could lift a hand, Bodine was in the saddle and gone.
Damn the man! His orders were to stay with the patrol.
Did you hear them orders put like that personal, Lieutenant? Bodine's orders is usually to scout for the patrol. I expect that's what he's gone off to do.
Are we supposed to wait here for him?
Don't make no difference, Lieutenant. Bodine will find us.
Bodine used the senses the good Lord gave him, such as looking at something and seeing it in its entirety. It was logical to Bodine to assume that if the colonel sent a patrol out on a 5-day scout, there would be 2.5 days out and 2.5 days back. It was now the downswing of the third day, which meant the patrol would be going back to the fort. An hour before dusk, Bodine came upon a small band of Blood Indians, distant relatives of the Blackfoot. Bodine lifted his hand in greeting, and it was returned.
I'm looking for my brother, Two Wolves.
You are Bodine.
who used to be called He Who Falls Down a Lot?
Yes.
The Blood sub-chief pointed toward the mountains.
There. It is odd that a man who scouts for the Bluebellies would be a Tsetse's Tas.
My adopted father, Medicine Horse, proclaimed me to be one of the people, a human being.
It is good. Medicine Horse is a wise chief.
He lifted his hand in farewell and was gone without a glance back at Bodine. Bodine rode for the mountains and made camp at dark, deliberately building a fire much larger than he normally would. Usually after eating, he would move several miles farther on before making camp for the night. Instead, Bodine was in his blankets, but he was far from asleep. His blood brother, Two Wolves, was as much a loner as he, preferring the solitary beauty of the vast and empty wilderness. Two Wolves did not run with a band of renegade young bucks, for Two Wolves was much like his father, Medicine Horse. Two Wolves was not at war with all the whites, just a few of them. Bodine waited for the arrival of his blood brother. The stallion stopped grazing and lifted his head, ears alert. Bodine tensed under the blanket, one hand gripping the edge of the blanket. A whisper of a moccasin on grass reached him, followed by the faint smell of grease and wood smoke. Bodine exploded out of his bedroll just as a buckskin-clad shape came hurling out of the night. Bodine flipped the blanket over the shape, grabbed the ends tightly, and using his foot, tripped the man, sending him to the ground. Two Wolves rolled, freeing himself from the blinding blanket, and leaped at Bodine, his hands reaching for the man's throat. Bodine sidestepped and grabbed a wrist, turning as he did, and using a hip, he tossed his blood brother to the ground. Two Wolves came up and slapped Bodine open-handed. The blow stung, smarting Bodine's cheek and wetting his eyes. Bodine promptly returned the slap, twisting Two Wolves around. The stallion had returned to grazing. He had seen all this foolishness many times before. Grabbing Two Wolves around the waist, Bodine lifted him off his feet and threw him to the ground.
It was your turn anyway. I graciously allowed you to win.
You allowed me nothing, brother. Come, sit. Coffee's hot. Have you eaten?
I nooned. How did you find me?
I saw a small band of Bloods. They said you were in the mountains.
There are many mountains.
But only one where we summered that time.
This is true.
The two men, although not related by family, could easily pass for physical brothers. They were both the same age and both possessed the same lean-hipped musculature. One pair of eyes were black, the other blue. One had raven-black hair. Bodine's hair was dark brown. Both wore the same type of three-stone necklace.
Why did you come to the mountains?
To see you. Also, man was tortured to death not far from Cutter. Happened early this morning. Some are placing the blame on you.
You'd know better.
Why are they blaming it on you?
They have to do something to create more hate towards me. Why not this?
Do you know who might have done it?
Any of 100 people. Everyone knows I am Onihonaham, friend of the wolf.
No more than I am, brother.
Both men revered the wolf and had crawled up into wolf dens many times in their youth.
So, it is solely because of your deep concern for our brother the wolf that the white man wants to see you dead?
But of course.
The wolves kill cattle, brother.
So does the rain which produces floods, and the lightning and thunder which causes the cattle to stampede, and the wind can hold tornadoes. The white man is a stupid creature. That which he does not understand, and will make no effort to understand, he wishes to destroy.
Now more truth.
My father and his small tribe were given the land they now live on, correct? To be theirs forever and ever.
Yes. That was part of the Treaty of 1868. The same treaty that closed the Bozeman Road and abandoned Forts Phil Kearny, Reno, and C.F. Smith.
Uh-huh. And that same treaty created a reservation, guaranteeing that all lands west of the Missouri River to the borders of Montana and Wyoming would be Sioux and Cheyenne forever and ever, correct?
This is true.
The white man lied. Again.
Unless, of course, the land has shrunk without our knowing it.
The land has not shrunk. But your father's land has not been bothered.
Ah, not yet. Hear me well, brother. The northern and southern Cheyenne are talking. The Sisitas and the Sutai. The men. The white man separated us from our friends, the Arapaho, and stuck us with the Crow, those eaters of dung.
I recall Medicine Horse saying you were at peace with them for a time.
Long before we were born. And then for only 3 years. That is not the point, and please stop changing the subject. Now listen to me, Bodine. The Shishiniwaihi Tanyu has begun in some areas.
Bodine's eyes narrowed at that news. The snake dance. The Comanches, themselves feared fighters, had been driven from their lands by the Cheyenne. The Cheyenne had given the name Shishiniwaihitanyu to the Comanche, not intending it to be a compliment, for literally translated, it meant snake men. To some Cheyenne, it became a victory dance, and a dance before war. The Cheyenne were feared by most of the Plains Indians, with the exception of the Sioux. While the tribes did fight, there was never the open hatred that existed between the Cheyenne and the Crow, the Dakotas, the Assiniboines, and the Kiowas. The last great battle the Cheyenne fought with the Kiowas, the Comanches, and the Apaches took place in 1838. In 1840, a truce was made that had not been broken to date.
You know that the Cheyenne are the greatest warriors who have ever lived. You know that when my people met the Assiniboines, the Hohes, we were defeated because the Hohes had guns and we did not. It was a relative of mine that rallied the Cheyenne and said, "The Hohes have attacked us and killed some of us. Now I say that from this time on, we shall fight with all people we meet, and then we shall become great warriors." There is war talk, my brother. Even in the lodges in my father's camps, there is war talk. If this pompous strutting rancher, this Tom Thomas, causes my father and his followers to be pushed off land that was given to them by the president himself, there will be war.
You cannot win a war against the whites, Two Wolves. They are too many. They are like ants. They just keep coming and coming in an endless march across the plains. It's 1875, Two Wolves. You cannot stop progress. But I will see what I can do about this Tom Thomas. I've heard of him. And he's an arrogant one, all right. Is he hiring gun hands?
Yes.
Simon Bull?
He is one of them. So I have been told. And he also has a man from the east, New York City, I'm also told, whose name is Whacker Corrigan.
He's a bully. They're henchmen of crooked politicians hired to keep the people in line and make sure they vote the way they're told to vote.
What a marvelous thing, this democratic system of the white man.
Bodine caught up with the patrol when they were halfway between Cutter and the small garrison on the Tongue.
How the devil did you... Never mind. Did you find out anything?
Two Wolves didn't kill that man. He told me.
You saw him?
Of course. He's my brother.
Why didn't you bring him in, damn it? You know we want to talk to him.
I'm paid to scout for the army, not arrest people.
Bodine, what would you do if the Cheyenne attacked this patrol?
They won't.
What would you do if the Sioux attacked this patrol?
They won't.
Damn it, man!
If Indians attacked this patrol, Lieutenant, I would fight.
But against whom? Them or us?
Back in Colonel Travers' office, Gary attempted to pursue the topic of Bodine's loyalty.
You're out of line, Lieutenant. Bodine sides with the Indians when he thinks they're in the right, and tells them up front when he thinks they're wrong.
I don't trust him. I won't go over your head, Colonel, but I do wish to lodge a written protest.
Colonel Travers had been in the Army since the early 50s, a well-thought-of man and a highly capable leader. He was a veteran of 4 years of fighting during the Civil War and 10 years on the Plains. He had fought Indians and had many friends among the various Indian tribes. He respected the Indian and knew that in many cases, but not as many as the Eastern press allowed, the Indian had been given the short end of the stick in dealings with the white man.
Write your letter of protest, Lieutenant. I'll put it in your file.
Thank you, sir.
Gary saluted, wheeled about, and left the office, his back as stiff and unbending as his neck. Travers walked to the door and called for his sergeant.
Get Bodine for me.
When the scout arrived, Travers waved him to a chair and poured them coffee.
Lieutenant Gary doesn't trust you, Matt.
I figured that out myself, Colonel. Maybe it's time for me to resign.
Travers sat down behind his desk and stared at the scout.
In a way, yes. But you'd still be on the Army's payroll. I'm going to tell you something, Bodine. Unlike Lieutenant Gary, I know you and trust you to do the right thing. General Sheridan has ordered an examination of the Yellowstone River, from its mouth to the junction with the Bighorn.
You're not serious.
There's more. He's also ordered that several sites be recommended for permanent army bases, forts from which Indian raids could be controlled. General Forsyth and Colonel Grant are to be in charge. The expedition is to be kept as secret as possible.
Damn it, Colonel! That area was to be set aside for the Crow and the Cheyenne. A stupid move if ever the government made one, knowing how Crow and Cheyenne feel about each other. Now this, on top of that fool rancher Tom Thomas?
The tribes will be given land a bit farther south of the original proposal.
Oh, sure. So Tom Thomas can have the best water and the best graze, and to hell with promises made to the Indians.
It wasn't my idea, Bodine. I just follow orders. The expedition will leave Fort Buford on May the 26th. 3 companies of infantry, 350 rounds of ammunition per man, a Gatling gun, and 1 month's rations for the field.
And you want me to do what?
Ride up there and tell your Indian friends to leave the troops alone.
Oh, is that all? Colonel, I don't have that many friends up in that area. That's Crow, Nez Perce, and Gros Ventre country. And you know as well as I that they are heavily armed and spoiling for a fight. The Nez Perce and Gros Ventre I can talk with. But the Crows hate me.
If you don't want the job, Bodine, just say so.
You don't have anyone else to send, do you?
No, I don't.
I might take a friend with me.
Bodine.
You want me to take the job or not?
All right, Bodine, do it your way. You got a couple of weeks to decide how to best approach it. George Custer is making big talk about how he would deal with the Indian problem.
Yellowhair is a pompous jackass.
True, but you didn't hear me say that. Whatever our personal feelings, George is a very capable soldier.
He's going to get a lot of people killed, Colonel. Mark that down in your book. I don't know where or when, but Yellowhair is heading for a lot of bad trouble and a hard fall. All right, Colonel. I'll ride for the north. I'll leave in a week. I want to see my folks before I go.
Bodine headed south, out of Montana and into Wyoming, back into his home range. He followed trails that he had been riding since he was just a boy. He crossed the clear and then, 12 miles later, forded the Crazy Woman, riding up to his parents' ranch just in time for supper.
Good Lord, boy! When's the last time you had a bath?
I reckon about 4 days ago, Ma.
She pointed to the house.
Go.
Yes, ma'am.
Sarah Bodine watched her oldest go into the house. His father waved at an old ranch hand and pointed at Bodine's horse. The old man was one of the few who could handle the mean-eyed stallion named Rowdy.
He'll be 25 in August, Matthew. Where have the years gone?
Good years, Mother. They were so good, we didn't even notice they were passing by.
Bodine's younger brother, Carl, was third in command of the ranch, with the foreman being the number two man. His sister, Betty, was 17 and looking for a husband. She had her eyes on an unsuspecting young man from the nearby town of Gillette, only some 35 miles away to the east. While Bodine was soaping and scrubbing, Betty stole his clothes, and when Bodine stepped out of the wooden tub, he found he was left with only his boots and gun belt.
What the? Oh, very funny.
He wore one holster in front and the other in back while he beat it to his room. Betty made up with her brother by baking a huge apple pie sprinkled lavishly with cinnamon and sugar. Bodine vocally forgave her, but his sister knew from the gleam in her brother's eyes that she'd be wise to inspect her bed carefully, because there was probably going to be a dead fish under the covers at best. or a live grass snake at worst. When Bodine indicated he had things to say after supper, there was no talk of the ladies doing the dishes while the men discussed matters of great importance. This was still the wild frontier, and the women shared in everything. The whole family took coffee and sat out on the front porch.
Seen your blood brother lately, son?
A few days ago, up north of here. He's fine, sends his best. He'd like to see you all, but conditions being what they are, he knew you'd understand why it was best he stayed away.
Medicine Horse came by the other night. He's worried.
He should be. I have to go away for about a month. While I'm gone, I want you to stock up on ammunition. No one rides alone. No Cheyenne is going to bother us, and probably most Sioux aren't. But there are always going to be renegade bands looking to make a name for themselves. Trouble's coming. If this country can survive the next year or 18 months, we'll be home free for the most part.
Those damn politicians aren't going to back out on agreements with the Indians, are they? Medicine Horse and his people?
He'll have to fight, Father. He'll have no choice in the matter.
Bodine spent the next few days letting Rowdy get a good long rest with all the corn he could eat. He knew that after 3 days of inactivity, the big stallion would be tearing down the barn to get back on the trail.
Looks like you're packing for two, son.
That could be.
Two Wolves throws a pretty wide loop, son. He was spotted over on the clear a couple months back.
He swings wide, that's for sure. But I pity the men who ever try to take him.
It might be you someday, son. You ever think about that?
I've thought of it. So far, he hasn't done anything worth killing over, to my mind.
There are those who won't agree with you.
Not to my face, they won't.
Bodine pulled out under a sky filled with stars, pointing Rowdy's nose north. He topped a ridge just at dawn and found himself face to face with a dozen Cheyenne. They were not painted for war, but they were traveling light and heavily armed. They were not of Medicine Horse's lodges. Several of them had bloody scalps tied onto their reins. Crow scalps, from the look of them. Probably scouts the band had ambushed. A young sub-chief nodded to him.
Bodine! Does Bodine ride to help the soldiers who are preparing to invade us to the north?
So much for the secrecy of this mission.
I ride in search of my brother, Two Wolves. It is my hope that Two Wolves will ride with me to the north to talk among the tribes, to let the soldiers come and go in peace, as long as they do not break the peace. You know my name, but I do not know yours.
I am Maetishomio.
I have heard of pushing ahead. You are said to be a great warrior. Around the fires, many songs have been sung about you.
And songs have been sung about Bodine. I have sung songs about Bodine.
I'm humbled and honored.
Two Wolves is on the mountain.
Pushing ahead pointed north. He turned his pony's head and led his band away from Bodine. Bodine sat his saddle and watched the northern Cheyenne until they had faded into the hills, heading east. Bodine swung Rowdy's head and rode straight east for an hour before once more cutting north. That the northern Cheyenne were this far south worried him. It could mean that a gathering had been called for. That meant trouble. Bodine thought about the country west of him. If a gathering had been called for, and he was the site chooser, Bodine would pick the Rosebud Mountains, maybe even close to the Little Bighorn. Later that night, the Blood Brothers shared the light and warmth of a small fire.
The people know about the expedition, Bodine. When it is over, there will be much dancing and feasting as the scalps dry on the lodge poles.
No, Two Wolves. That cannot be allowed to happen.
Did I say the scalps would be hair from the soldiers? You are reading things in my words that are not there, Bodine.
Brother, there must be no trouble.
There are 300 lodges of crows.
Two Wolves drew a winding line in the dirt that Bodine recognized as the narrows above the mouth of the Bighorn River. He jabbed at another spot on the twisting line.
The crows claim to have thousands of rounds of ammunition for their sharps. Sitting Bull is here. A day before the bluebellies arrive, the Sioux will strike and the crows will die.
Wagons full of new uniforms were taken some months ago and a Gatling gun was stolen about the same time. Several months ago, cannons were stolen.
I know nothing of any uniforms or Gatling guns.
It's an ambush, brother.
Of course it's an ambush. Sitting Bull's warriors will kill the Crow. I just explained that to you.
50 or 60 men could do it. If they were very careful and knew the terrain, they could pull it off. The Crows would blame the army and would then stop all assistance. The Sioux would blame the army and the Crows and then declare war on the whites.
Who would stand to gain by such a move, Bodine?
People who want the land the Indians occupy. Those who want the Indian rounded up and confined, or killed. This would be an easy way to get rid of a lot of homesteaders, Two Wolves. My dad told me about this Tom Thomas. He's a very ambitious man and doesn't care how he achieves his goals. A lot of this is prime land, brother. And some still believe gold is there for the taking. You can bet that Tom Thomas is behind this plan.
But can you prove it?
No. And he's too cunning to allow himself to get caught. He'll do the planning behind the scenes and allow others to do the dirty work.
Have you ever met with Sitting Bull or Crazy Horse, Bodine?
No.
Sitting Bull is a very powerful Unkpapa medicine man. He does not trust the white man. That will probably include you, Bodine. If we get inside the village, you'll be safe. Leaving might present a problem for you.
Before dawn, the men were riding. They rode north for a time, and then turned west toward the Rosebud. The days were blistering hot, and the nights cold. They saw no white men for the first 2 days. At midday of the third day, they saw smoke from a cabin and veered toward it. As they drew nearer, they could make out 3 cabins with about 200 yards between them. A large barn obviously served all 3 families.
Smart. Strength in numbers. Probably be a town here someday.
Don't count on it. A gathering has been called, Bodine. It has been almost 7 years since the Sioux signed the treaty guaranteeing them the land around their sacred Black Hills. Since that time, all the white man has done is lie and break promises, allowing other whites in to dig up the earth for gold.
Bodine glanced at Two Wolves. Except for his shoulder-length hair, he could pass for a white man. He hoped none of those settlers whose homes they approached would panic and shoot Two Wolves out of the saddle. 4 men suddenly appeared out of their homes, each with a rifle.
State your business!
Women in the buildings by the windows. They're armed.
I see them. I am Bodine, Army Scout. This is Sam Webster with me.
What the hell?
You want to be a dead Two Wolves or a live Sam?
Welcome then, Bodine. I've heard of you. All right, and sit. The women's got grub on.
Over a noon meal of venison and beans and cornbread, Bodine tried to keep the talk light, but the men would have none of that.
Damn Injuns, riding through the country again. Seen a whole parcel of them day before yesterday, heading west. They didn't bother us none, but that don't make me trust them no more than I ever has.
They got matching necklaces, Mama.
A little girl pointed to the multicolored stones around the men's necks.
We're blood brothers, ma'am. Sam is half Cheyenne.
The settlers looked at Two Wolves as if he had suddenly grown horns and a tail.
And I am an adopted member of the Cheyenne tribe.
I don't see how you stand it. Injuns smell different.
As you do to us. Oh. This is really excellent venison, ma'am. Almost as good as dog.
Well, I never.
We must be going, folks. Thanks for the meal.
The family spoke not a word as the 2 men beat a hasty retreat from the cabin. Once in the yard, they swung up into leather and rode away.
You ought to be ashamed of yourself, brother. I know damn well you've never eaten a dog in your life.
Of course not. My mother did change that much about my father's tribe. But did you see the expression on that woman's face?
Ha!
Two Wolves jumped his horse ahead of Bodine's, and the race was on. They left their horses and carefully climbed up a ridge overlooking the Crow encampment.
Jesus.
Even more lodges than I expected. I would say 500 in all.
Does Sitting Bull trust you?
Yes.
Right. I'll try to convince them to meet with the Sioux. I'll see you in Lost Valley in 2 days.
They made their way back to their horses, a good mile from the Crow camp.
A Big Face is the chief of this gathering of cowardly coyotes. He is a snake who will strike when your back is turned. Don't trust him.
Two wolves. Do you even know why you hate the Crow?
Of course.
Yeah! Crazy son of a...
Bodine rode slowly toward the huge Indian encampment. He really was not expecting any trouble from the Crows. They all knew he worked for the army, and most Crows were friendly toward the whites. Bodine knew that there was almost never any trouble getting into an Indian's camp. While you were there, the Indians would feed you and provide you a place to sleep. Trying to leave was the problem. He rode slowly toward the center of the camp, trying to find the largest and most highly decorated teepee. That one would belong to Big Face. Bodine reined up in front of what appeared to be a sub-chief's lodge and dismounted. The flap was pushed open, and a huge Indian stepped out.
Fat Bear, I come with news of great importance.
I admire Bodine's courage. The adopted son of the Cheyenne is either a very brave man or a fool.
I've ridden far to bring news. I'm hungry.
I'm sorry. I have forgotten our ways.
He struck himself on the chest as punishment, called for his woman to bring bowls of food, and instructed his children to bring robes for them to sit on. After a mostly silent meal of venison and Indian pudding, corn, milk, and honey, with eating being serious business with no place for talk, Bodine smacked his lips and rubbed the grease from his hands onto his forearms.
Fat Bear is a great man.
This is truth.
I would want no other than Fat Bear to ask Big Face to meet with me.
Fat Bear would be the only one who could arrange that. Bodine was wise to come to me.
Any of the tribe's sub-chiefs could have approached Big Face, but a little ego-stroking never hurt.
I will see Big Face. Eat. Eat, Bodine. Your trail has been long. You and your brother, Two Wolves, have ridden hard.
Bodine expected that.
My brother has gone to see the Sioux. He carries the same news as I.
Why did Two Wolves go to the Sioux and not you?
Because I do not know Sitting Bull. I know you.
Fat Bear nodded his head, accepting that as logical. He walked away, disappearing into the village. A moment later, he returned and waved Bodine toward him.
Big Face will talk with you. Come.
When Bodine saw that no pipe was present, he knew that he was not trusted, and that this was not going to be a terribly friendly meeting. At least not at first. He was going to have to be convincing. Big Face had the tribe's medicine man with him, as well as a dozen sub-chiefs. Fat Bear sat down beside Bodine and looked at him.
Speak, Bodine.
I believe that certain white men are going to try to trick the Crow and the Sioux. The Sioux have plans to attack the Crow here in your camp. An attack by the Sioux would not be unexpected, and you and your braves would surely win the battle, killing the Sioux.
They probably would not win, but once again, Bodine practiced ego-stroking.
How are the white men going to try and trick us, Bodine? And why? We have been friends with the whites for many years.
Because of that friendship. And these white men that I speak of want you all, every Indian, everywhere, to be confined to reservations. They do not want you to be allowed to leave the reservation to hunt. They want your lands. And they want you to declare war against the white settlers to drive them out, so their land can be taken over by greedy men.
That may be why. Now the how of it.
Uniforms of the whites have been stolen, along with cannons and the Gatling gun. The army plans an expedition on the Yellowstone. They will be exploring, not hunting war. Men in their uniforms can lay blame where it does not belong and start a war.
It is a good plan. Before the real soldiers get here, the fake pony soldiers will attack us, killing many, and we will think the army has turned on us. It would be their hope that the Crow and the Sioux would become as one against the whites. It is a good plan, but it is also foolish. The Crow and the Sioux will never be friends. When we meet, we fight. It has been that way forever.
This is truth. But I know that Big Face and his warriors are giant people. And they can see the wisdom in putting aside their hatred for a month to make sure this silly plan will fail.
Oh, of course, we would do that. The Crow are not only braver, but much wiser than the Sioux. But would the Unkpapa and the Ogallala do the same?
That is what my brother, Two Wolves, will try to arrange when he gets to the Sioux camp in the morning.
How do we know we can trust you, Bodine?
You don't. But here is what I will do. If an agreement can be made between the Crow and the Sioux not to fight during this period of exploration, I will ride to intercept the army on the river and tell them of the plan. Tell them of the fake soldiers. Your scouts and the Sioux scouts can find the fake soldiers and the army can arrest them. I will then return here, and here I will stay, in this camp, until it is over. I can offer you no more than my life.
And Two Wolves?
I cannot speak for another man.
This is truth. Only a fool tries to put words in another's mouth. Leave us, Bodine. We will talk this out. A teepee has been readied for you. Rest. We will call you when we have decided.
In the Sioux camp, Two Wolves sat with the people, explaining his appeal. A sub-chief named Lone Dog leapt to his feet.
It is a trap!
Sitting Bull held up a hand.
I think it is not. Bodine has gone to the camp of the Dung-Eaters, where he is not welcomed and not liked.
We don't know that!
You would not be able to speak to me in such a manner if your tongue were removed and fed to the coyotes.
Lone Dog shut his mouth. The Oglala chief, Crazy Horse, raised a hand.
Two Wolves is a man of truth like his father, Medicine Horse. I believe him. This would be something that Tom Thomas would do. I think that in a very few months, the town of Cutter will be no more.
It is nothing but a rotten mass of maggots anyway. It will not be missed.
I shall lead the attack against this Tom Thomas and the den of thieves at Cutter.
But for now, see to the needs of Two Wolves' horse.
All the Sioux sub-chiefs seated around the leaders put their hands to their mouths to hide their laughter. Lone Dog stalked away, his back stiff with anger. The pipe was lit and passed around.
One good laugh is not enough for a day. Two Wolves, tell us again how He Who Falls Down a Lot got his name.
Very well. One day the boy Matthew Bodine was riding a good 3 miles from the small ranch and farm where he grew up, even though his father had told him time and again to not stray far from the house. But when you're a young boy with a fast pony, it's hard to stay put when there is so much country that begs to be investigated.
Matthew might be only 10 years old, but he figured he could ride with the best of them, and his little paint pony could fly. So Matthew set out to practice his roping on some cows, but he found a wild, skinny Indian before he came to the herd. Well, sort of a wild Indian, but he was skinny-looking. The Indian's pony had stepped into a prairie dog hole and went head over hocks, breaking its neck when it landed and pinning the Indian under its body. At least Matthew thought it was an Indian. The boy trapped beneath the dead horse was brown like an Indian and had dark hair, but there was something about the face that didn't ring true with the other Indians that Matthew had seen. The boy also wore a necklace of 3 multicolored stones, pierced with a leather thong. The boy's eyes were open, and they weren't blinking. They were dark like an Indian's. Whatever the tribe, the boy looked dead to Matthew. But his dad had said you sometimes couldn't trust an Indian. They'd fake you up close and then jump up and stick a knife in you.
Hey, are you dead?
The dark eyes shifted, watching him. The Indian boy said nothing.
All right, so you ain't dead. What's the matter, cat got your tongue?
The boy spat at Matthew.
My dad was right. You're all savages.
No, Cheyenne.
Matthew was startled. Indians don't talk English like Americans. But this one did. And it was then that Matthew began adding things up, such as if there was one Indian, it stood to reason that there were more around. He stood up in his stirrups and looked all around him, but he could not see anything past the first of the rolling hills. He looked back at the Indian boy.
Is your leg busted?
Broken? No. Trapped.
You speak good English. All right, so your leg ain't broke, just trapped.
Matthew slid off his pony and walked up to the boy, but not close enough for the boy to make a grab at him.
If I had any sense, I'd hightail it back to the house and get my paw.
What's the matter? Are you afraid of me?
I ain't scared of nothing.
Medicine Horse Says whites tremble like old women when the Cheyenne come around.
Medicine Horse? Is that your pa's name?
Yes. Great chief.
Matthew turned around and walked back to his horse.
You leave me?
No.
Matthew took a canteen from the saddle horn and walked back to the trapped boy. He knelt down and held out the canteen.
You want a drink?
The boy took the canteen, pulling the plug and drinking deeply. He nodded his head in thanks and handed the canteen to Matthew. He hesitated, then drank without wiping it clean. The Indian watched him closely.
How long you been here?
Since dawn.
It was about 10 o'clock. Long time to be trapped under a dead horse.
How come your folks ain't looking for you?
They look, not find.
Why didn't you holler for them?
So white men can find me and kill me?
My dad wouldn't have hurt you.
I don't know that. But I see your pony and come to steal it.
Steal my horse? But you got a horse. Well, had a horse.
I want more.
It's wrong to steal.
Not from your enemy.
I'm not your enemy.
Maybe not. We'll see.
You got a name?
Two Wolves.
I'm Matthew. Call me Matt. Look here, Two Wolves. If I get you out, what are you gonna do?
Join my people.
But where are they?
I know where.
Matthew sat back on his heels and thought for a moment.
Let me have your knife.
Why?
Well, I gotta dig a trench so as you can pull your leg free. You gotta trust someone sometime, don't you?
Two Wolves thought for a long moment, then slowly pulled a long-bladed knife from a beaded sheath and handed it to Matthew. Matthew went to work, being careful not to cut Two Wolves' swollen leg. So intent was he in his work, he did not hear the horses walk up the hill, the riders sitting their mounts on the crest of the knoll and watching. But Two Wolves saw them. Matthew was sweating by the time he finished.
Okay, let's give her a try, Two Wolves.
Between the two of them, one pushing and the other pulling, Two Wolves pulled his leg free and lay back on the grass, clearly in a great deal of pain, although it showed only in his eyes. Matthew handed the knife back to Two Wolves, handle first. The Indian boy managed to smile and sheathed the blade.
How you gonna walk, Two Wolves? Look here, let me get you on my horse and take you home with me. Ma can take a look at that leg.
I will not have to walk, Matthew. I ride with them.
Two Wolves pointed.
Huh?
Matthew whirled around, lost his balance in the loose dirt, and fell on his butt. He stared in horror at a dozen or more Indians sitting their ponies on the crest of a hill. The Indians slowly walked their ponies down the hill, leaving one brave to watch the house far in the distance. The Indians carried old muskets, spears, and bows with quivers of arrows on their backs. Matthew almost peed himself. A handsome brave wearing three feathers and a beaded headband walked his horse up to Matthew and Two Wolves. Matthew struggled to stand, still dizzy, and promptly fell over again.
He saved your life.
You would have phoned me long before I died, so it doesn't count.
But it does. I have spoken.
He looked at Matthew, his dark eyes not giving much away. But there was a definite twinkle in those eyes. Two Wolves climbed painfully to his feet. Matthew rose and turned to help, and Two Wolves waved him back. He hobbled to the brave and grabbed onto the man's outstretched arm, swinging up behind him. The man stared long at Matthew.
I am Medicine Horse, chief of the Cheyenne. A life saved is a life owed.
He removed a necklace identical to Two Wolves and tossed it to Matthew. Matthew fell down, catching it.
Ride safe among us. I shall call you He Who Falls Down a Lot.
It was a meeting that would have gone down in the history books, if any historians had been aware of it. Big Face sent Fat Bear, and the Sioux sent Running Man to meet in Lost Valley. Big Face said if he even looked at a Sioux, it would be so disgusting a sight, his head would hurt for a week. And Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull both agreed that for men of their position to look upon the ugliness of any crow would be worse than stepping barefoot into a fresh pile of buffalo dung. Running Man of the Sioux and Fat Bear of the Crow sat with their backs to each other and talked.
I sit this way because I do not want my eyes contaminated by the sight of that bloated crow pig.
I sit this way because I do not want my eyes to be forever crossed by gazing, however briefly, on the ugliness of a Sioux puss face.
Now that we have most of the pleasantries out of the way, would anyone care to smoke the pipe?
I would rather kiss a vulture.
You both know why we are here. Is it agreed that the Crow and the Sioux will not fight during the time of the army expedition on the Yellowstone?
Big Face has agreed to this.
Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull have agreed to this.
I don't suppose you'd like to shake hands on it.
With their backs to one another, the men stuck their hands out and shook hands with the air. Both men then vigorously wiped their hands on the grass.
Is this all?
The pact is agreed upon.
Good. The smell of that rotting coyote is very offensive to me.
Likewise, the smell of cowardice is nearly overpowering.
That's it. This meeting is concluded.
The Crow and the Sioux stood up and walked to their horses and rode away. Not once did they look back at each other.
I'd have never believed it.
As soon as the army leaves the Yellowstone, they'll be back at war.
Just as long as we can help trap those phony soldiers and perhaps expose Tom Thomas, they can go back to fighting.
Where will you intercept the army?
They left on May 26th. This is the 29th, unless my reckoning is wrong. I can't be seen in any towns. Thomas may have people looking for anything out of the ordinary. I'll intercept them between the Tongue and the Rosebud.
Do you have to return to the Crow camp?
No. I offered to, but Big Face said it wasn't necessary. As soon as I tip off the army, I'll get word to you, somehow, and you can join me.
You want me to roam around between the camps and make sure the agreement is not violated?
I'd appreciate it. Do you think Lone Dog is going to cause any trouble?
Yes. Just as soon as the army leaves the Yellowstone, I'm convinced that Lone Dog will break with Sitting Bull and start attacking the settlers. I don't think we can stop him. And the town of Cutter is going to be wiped from the face of the map, brother.
I'm going to be traveling fast. I'll take only a few supplies and leave the rest with you.
Ride safe, brother.
Bodine rode the north side of the Yellowstone, heading east for the mouth of the Rosebud. He intended to avoid all the little settlements that had sprung up on the Yellowstone, but Rowdy broke a shoe and forced a change in his plans. On foot, leading Rowdy, Bodine walked into a small village and up to the blacksmith shop. The smithy took one look at Rowdy.
I ain't touching that bastard.
I ain't asking you to. I'll shoe him. Come on, boy.
Rowdy showed his teeth to the smithy as Bodine bent to the task.
Listen, your name wouldn't be Bodine, would it? Look, I ain't trying to be nosy. It's just they some hard cases over the saloon. My boy was fetching me a bucket of beer this noon and heard him talking. If your name's Bodine, them gunnies is here to kill you.
Yeah, I'm Bodine.
Then you better ride, mister. One of them old boys is Utah Jack Noyes, and my boy says he heard one of them men say someone named Thomas has got hired guns all up and down the river hunting you.
So someone at the fort was in Thomas's pocket. He was a rich man and didn't mind spreading his wealth around to get what he wanted. Bodine finished shoeing Rowdy and put him in a stall. After rubbing him down, he gave him some corn and patted the dun on the rump.
Relax, Rowdy. I got some business to take care of.